Hello, I'm Emma Rutland, the Duchess of Rutland, and this is my podcast, Duchess, a podcast in which I explore the most historic homes in the UK and meet the inspiring women who lead them. As a daughter of a Welsh farmer, I grew up far away from the glamour and wealth of aristocracy. But my life changed forever when I fell in love and married my husband, the 11th Duke of Rutland. Suddenly, one of Britain's most historic buildings was not only my home, but under my care. I wanted to learn more about this world and hear the stories of the other women, like me, the custodians of these great homes. So, in this podcast, I will travel to breathtaking homes, learn incredible history, and meet the inspiring women who lead these estates today. So please do join me on my very special journey. This is Duchess, the podcast. Before we get started, I'd like to say thank you to our wonderful sponsor, Circle DNA. For those who may not know, Circle DNA is a company that specializes in finding smarter, easier, and more effective solutions to your health by testing your DNA. Listeners, you know how much I love to learn about family history and lineage, and I found my Circle Premium results absolutely fascinating. I learned so much about myself, from my diet and nutrition, skin and fitness, to common diseases and cancer risks. When my daughter Violet and I did the test, we even learned she had a sensitivity to spicy food. That explains why she has been kicking up a fuss at the dinner table for all these years. If you sign up to Circle DNA, you will receive your DNA testing kit in the post. Use the easy-to-follow testing instructions to self-swab at home. Send your completed swab to their laboratory for analysis, and within 3 weeks, you'll receive your results and personalized recommendations. You will also have the opportunity to book 2 complimentary consultations, one with a health coach and one with a genetic counselor. To learn more about Circle DNA, visit their website and use the code THEDUCHESS40 for 40% off their DNA test kits. Hidden between the ancient woodland and pristine meandering rivers in Northamptonshire broods a Tudor Georgian masterpiece of architectural design, Dean Park. Since the Norman Conquest, a manor has resided at Dean. With its age, its connection to Westminster Abbey, and the influence of the family that's lived here for over 500 years, Dean has become an eclectic and totally unique architectural mix. The front gate of Dean is a vista, beautifully adorned by trees on each side, that stretches for what seems like a sublime eternity. The powerful brow of the home itself is crenellated with a stone that glimmers almost golden in the sun. On the opposite side, there's a wonderful garden that even among such splendour stands out. But the real treasure of Dean Park resides inside. Charlotte Brudenell became the custodian of Dean when she married her husband Robert almost 2 decades ago. As an architectural historian, her insight light and enthusiasm for the estate shines in every word she says. In this episode, Charlotte introduces me to the eccentric Earl that was immortalized by one of English poetry's greatest works. We discuss Dean's incredible association to the Magna Carta, and Charlotte reveals the saucy 19th century discovery that would have had many of us at a time blush. Thank you for having me, Charlotte, and what a joy it is. And I have to say, although we've known each other for many years, I've never seen your home. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
Where is Dean Park, just for our listeners?
We are at the top end of Northamptonshire. Northamptonshire is the famous county of squires and spires, and the reason being that it was close enough to get to court if you wanted to, but far enough away to hide from if you didn't want to get to court. And we're blessed at this top end of Northamptonshire by the belt of stone that starts off in Portland and works its way diagonally through the Cotswolds, through Oxfordshire, right up to the Lincolnshire and Yorkshire worlds. So we have this beautiful, beautiful stone, and there are a lot of big houses, particularly from the 16th century, that were built.
And this house dates back to?
Well, with the earliest recording we've got about it is from 1086, from the Domesday Book.
So here we are with the Brudenell family, who've been living here since
1514.
Goodness me. And how did they arrive again?
Well, Sir Robert Brudenell was head of the Court of Common Pleas. He acquired 15 different estates, and he plonked his second wife with his children here, and he chose Dean Park and took over the rent of £18 a year because it was close to the Collyweston Palace, which was where Margaret Beaufort, the mother of Henry VII, lived. And he was her finance advisor and her executor. So Henry VII would stay here on his way up before the last 8 or 10 miles it takes to get up there.
Goodness. Yeah. So did Henry VIII ever visit?
Henry VIII didn't come, no. His daughter did.
Did she?
Yes.
So you never actually were given titles, or is the title that faded out?
No. They had, they had the ability to purchase the odd title. And Thomas Brudenell, he bought Sir Thomas, and then he bought Lord Brudenell of Staunton Wyvil, which is the estate in Leicestershire. And then during the Civil War, he escaped to Wales. In 1643, the parliamentarian troops arrived here and sacked the house, and he skedaddled, and he ended up in the Tower of London, and his poor wife was left here holding the fort. And his son said to King Charles, here's £1,000 for your fighting fund. When all comes good, could you honour my father and his heirs with a title? And Thomas Brudenell was made the first Earl of Cardigan.
Goodness.
We don't know whether it's because he'd hid for 2 years in Wales or whether it was just the next name on the list, but we are about as far away from the sea here as you could imagine.
And Cardigan.
Yes.
And so what's happened to that title now?
7 earls lived here. And the 7th Earl was the famous Earl who led the charge of the Light Brigade, and he had no legitimate children. So he broke the entail. An entail means that when you die, your title and all your goods and lands go together to your next male heir, not female, male heir. And there were movements in the Victorian stage to break off the title from the land. And he was able to do that, which meant that the title went to a cousin of his, but the Dean estate went to his widow. So we have the house in the hinterland, but we have no title.
So there we are. And that I don't think would ever worry you.
Now I know which I'd rather have.
The 7th Earl was involved in which war, Charlotte?
In the Crimean War.
Your 7th Earl?
The 7th Earl, indeed, who had 6 sisters. I don't think I'd have liked him if I met him, and he certainly wouldn't have liked me. I think he was very, very spoilt, and I think he was slightly Aspergery. I think he had somebody who had his rules, he followed them, he didn't diverge, and expected everybody else to do what he wanted. Enormous amount of money and power as a result. The sort of person that if he dropped his handkerchief, he wouldn't even consider picking it up. There would be somebody there to pick it up for him.
And those sort of 6 sisters most probably endorsed that.
They were all married off terribly well. So one of them married Lord Lucan, and hence we had this problem with the charge of the Light Brigade.
Tell me about that.
What happened was that the Earl of Lucan was actually in charge of the Earl of Cardigan, and Lord Raglan sent Nolan to go and tell them to go and rescue the guns at either side of the valley. And Lucan turned round to his brother-in-law and said, off you go. And he said, but the guns are straight ahead, because they couldn't see them at the side. And he said, well, that's the orders. You've got to go. And he said, well, that's to certain death. And he said, orders are orders, off you go. And Lord Cardigan set off, and he said, here goes the last of the Brudenells, and led his troops. And then Nolan realised that they were heading towards the Russian guns at the end of the valley and rode in front of him, which was something you didn't do in front of an earl, pointing to the guns at either side, and was shot. He was killed by a cannonball, I think. Yep. So they charged down there, being fired at by the guns halfway down the valley, got to the very end, and then turned around and came back again.
Oh, my goodness.
So they did as they were told. They were very brave. That's what you did in the army. You didn't question it.
Yeah.
But there were questions asked afterwards. And I think Cardigan tried to put the blame on Lucan, and Lucan tried to put the blame on Raglan, and round and round it went. So it was a complete muddle in orders.
And so where did the Earl end up?
Oh, the Earl came back and went back to his yacht and drank champagne and came back to England fated as an absolute hero because he asked but to do and die the noble 600.
Tennyson wrote an amazing poem.
He did. The famous lines were, "There's not to make reply, there's not to reason why, there's but to do and die. Into the valley of death rode the 600.
How powerful.
Very powerful.
So the 7th Earl, Charlotte, was a fascinating man. He also had a fascinating wife, I believe.
Lord Cardigan met this beautiful Adeline, Horsey de Horsey was her name. In our guidebook, my late mother-in-law wrote that they had a very happy marriage, never worrying about marital infidelities, so they really were the very fast set. And we have this letter where a gentleman said, staying at Deane was a dangerous affair. Lady Cardigan divided the men into two sorts, the unkind ones who locked their bedroom doors and the kind ones who did not.
How interesting. And she was a keen smoker.
Yes.
But it was not popular to smoke then.
The other thing she did was she rode round the villages on a bicycle wearing her husband's cherry picker army trousers.
How fascinating. And was there a story that she used to dress up?
Oh, yes. She used to dress up and pretend to be a ghost. Yes.
I love the sound of Adeline. As a nun?
As a nun, yes. But everybody knew that it was her doing it. So I'm afraid ghosts, we may have some ghosts here. I've yet to meet one.
Oh, well, there we are. I should imagine they'd turn and run.
Yes.
And she was here for a long time after her husband died?
48 years.
Gosh.
Yes. But she was very, very beautiful. There can be no denial about it. She was absolutely stunning. I have a little point of order with her, was that I think in her 48 years worth of widowhood, she went on such a good shopping spree, it shrank in size, the Deane estate. She also didn't really look after Deane very much.
And so how did you bring it back from the brink?
Well, the house suffered from Lord Robert dying with death duties, Lady Cardigan dying with death duties, and Ernest, my husband's great uncle, killed in a trench at a Battle of Arras. So there was three set of death duties. And it wasn't until the Second World War that death duties were abandoned if you were killed fighting in the army. So three sets of death duties, and Deane was on its knees. Adeline Cardigan had spent as much as she could, so the house was in a very dire state. During the First World War, it was used as a convalescence place. An interesting story in 1937 was that the British Museum came up to this part of the world to see where they could store stuff from the British Museum in the event of a war. And they went to two other major houses nearby, and Deane failed spectacularly because there was no electricity.
And water coming in through the roof.
Yes, and only two stories. So it failed. So instead, during the Second World War, we had English, Irish, Czech and Polish troops based here. And the ones that caused the most damage were, I hate to say it, were the English troops.
Oh no.
Yes.
And that was a turning time, Charlotte, for these houses.
Completely. You couldn't do any remedial work. And after the war, of course, the country was busy using all their building materials to rebuild important houses and homes for everybody who'd lost them completely. So the houses really suffered for a good 10 years after the end of the war.
And that's the end of the Second World War.
Yes.
What I really have felt in the journey I've had at Beaver is that if you look at the lifestyle and how these houses were lived before the First World War, yes, rightly or wrongly, but nothing was to ever be the same again, was it?
Yes. And I think a lot of that was to do with the fact that women were recruited during the First World War, went into lovely jobs and decided they didn't want to go back
into service.
Yes.
Many of the people, such as your father-in-law and my father-in-law, really didn't think they were ever going to get back into these houses, particularly if they've been on the front line. I can remember David's granny, Kaku, waved off her three sons to war in the Second World War, not knowing any of them would have returned.
Oh.
And if they had all been killed, Beaver would have been left to the nearest male relation, who was a gardener in Sydney. So it's just the fate of time, really.
Yes, it is.
But that moment of coming back from war and all the trauma they must have been through going through the war and coming back into these houses. And then they had another battle, the battle of keeping their heritage together.
And weren't they brave doing so? Because so much work was done. I mean, Robert's parents made it their life's work to restore Deane.
As we're sitting in this magnificent room, Charlotte, what is this room called?
This is called the Ante Hall. And it was in the medieval days with the Great Hall. It was where you had your dairy and your pantry and whatever. And I love this room because it is full of 17th century portraits. We eat here when we are too few to eat in the dining room.
Just describe it to our listeners.
Well, we've got lovely green wallpaper on here. I can't tell you how many times I have gone round with my little pot of watercolours to fill in the gaps where the white started to show through. It's a very warm room, this.
And we're sitting round a fabulous sort of curved oval de-ended dining table, and not a speck of dust anywhere.
No.
So one of the things, surely with this wonderful house and stories and finding things behind panels and goodness knows what, have you found anything interesting, Charlotte, here that you can share with the listeners?
Well, luckily I have just recently. My mother-in-law, who's here for 60 years, did a fantastic job at uncovering virtually everything. But when we were restoring some of the furniture, I found a little envelope, and inside it, from the days of naughty Adeline Cardigan, we found a whole lot of circa 1900 condoms.
Did you?
Yes, and I have had three of them framed and put slightly tucked away because we obviously don't want to upset visitors. But on the other hand, those who've seen them have just rocked with laughter. And I think it's part of the history of the house that, you know, Dean Park was a pretty racy place in the end of the 19th century.
How extraordinary. Who framed them for you?
Oh, we took them into a framers in Uppingham who had to come down one by one to have a look at them because of COVID regulations in hysterics. And the great joy is that when they're framed flat. So they really do look really large.
Oh, I think the listeners will find that very amusing, and everyone will be wanting to find out where the framing of the 1900s
condoms. I haven't publicised it yet, so this is a first.
Goodness, this is fresh off the press. Charlotte, tell us about the architecture here at Dean Park.
Dean Park's a very unusual house because at a time when the Brunels were so rich they could have pulled it down in the 18th century and rebuilt it, they didn't. And when you come round Dean Park, you are actually going on an architectural romp because you see a little bit of medieval, you then see a bit of Tudor, you then see a bit of Jacobean, a bit of Georgian, a bit of Regency. Sadly, the Victorian part was a ballroom which was pulled down in the 1980s. And so, interestingly, we are a sort of guinea pig of absolutely everything. And I think people come round and go, oh, that's particularly good for Regency, or that's particularly good for Tudor.
The kaleidoscope.
Yeah.
So just tell me about your motto.
It was said at my late father-in-law's funeral by the lovely vicar who in fact married Robert and I. And I just snapped up on it because the past to cherish is what I do as I'm an architectural historian. And the future to relish is the fact that we're so blessed to live here.
So is this the new family motto?
My family motto, yes.
Oh, well done. Yeah. And what's the actual family motto?
It's called En grâce à fille, which means on God depend. Yes, yes.
On God depend, the past to cherish, the future to relish. Yes. I love that. That's magical. What I love the most about Charlotte's motto is how well it captures the essence of her. When speaking to her, you get the sense of passion and respect for what has come before, but you also instantaneously become aware of her forward-looking mindset and positivity. This is a quick reminder that you're listening to Duchess, hosted by me, Emma Rutland, and this is a podcast produced by One Fine Play in collaboration with Beaver Castle. Coming up in the show, we discuss Dean's amazing connection to the Magna Carta, and Charlotte reveals perhaps the best-kept secret of a British garden. But first, I wanted to hear more about the adjustment Charlotte and her family have made in order to move on to the estate. So Charlotte has been married to her wonderful Robert since, I think, 1998?
Yes.
And you have lived in the house at Dean Park for how long, Charlotte?
My late mother-in-law suddenly died, sadly, and my late father-in-law was riddled with Parkinson's and everybody thought he was going to go first. And it became very apparent that we had to move from our beautiful farmhouse at the other end of the village into the house to look after it. So coming up 7 years ago.
7 years. So it's been a bit of a baptism of fire.
Completely. No heating, no staff. Well, we had one or two. Not realising how the house worked, having to learn how the house worked so that you could adapt yourselves to it until you realise that you'd make the house adapt to you eventually. But it was a real, real learning curve. Yeah.
Roof? How was the roof?
Roof, not good. The lead roof had been ruined by the acid rain from British Steel in Corby and was probably only about a couple of millimetres thick. So it leaked horrendously.
Lot of buckets. So you didn't really bring William up here. And how did it feel when you all had to leave your cosy farmhouse?
I was in floods of tears. I still would love to go back to my perfect home, but we're here.
How does William feel about taking the mantle one day of this on?
T To be honest, I don't know. He was extraordinarily lucky because we moved in when he was 13. So he was just, they say if you don't move in before 16, you have no affinity with the property. And watching him take his friends round Dean, it's sort of growing. The osmosis of beautiful things around him is beginning to attach itself. Originally, it was, let's look at the billiard table, let's look at the ping pong room, let's look at the gun room. But now there's a little bit more pride in what there is here.
And one doesn't really blame them because actually it's their home.
I have to laugh. William, aged 13, said when we were moving in here, he said, Mummy, it's quite simple. No Wi-Fi, no William.
Oh, how wonderful. And before you actually got married, Charlotte, what did you do?
To start off with, I was an estate agent and I ended up being a director of one of the companies in London. I then went to work for 15 beautiful years for the National Art Collections Fund, organising their events and fundraising, which I absolutely loved. I then stopped when William was born and worked for Age Concerned. It was called RUCBA, looking after volunteers to visit elderly people who had issues of loneliness and no money, help them. And then when William went to prep school, I thought, well, I'll go and be re-educated. So I went off to Leicester University and did an MA on country houses, and I did my dissertation on the architectural history of Dean Park.
No.
Yes. So I had a very good grounding on that, yes.
And it feels that as we walk around the house today, as if every picture's been beautifully hung, even as you go into the rooms and she's got these amazing lift-out sort of histories on every room. Pop-up charts in every room.
I cannot take credit for that. I have to say that the decoration of the house was done by my late mother-in-law, whose taste was famously exquisite. And actually, I haven't changed that much. I've just tweaked a few bits. I will give her all the credit.
Absolutely. And that is the great thing about living in heritage, is that we take on what our predecessors' talents and bless them for having been, and then go forward and do our little bit. And so it's a long tapestry of hopefully a female feel.
Well, I think it's also quite important that you have to put a 21st century influence or adaption or usage on something that's older, because we all have to live in these houses. We can't let them rule our day-to-day
existence.
It sounds
like another naughty child. You've got to bring it at heel.
Yes, that's a very good description. After the dogs and the husband.
So where do you live in this wonderful building?
We live everywhere. We've got a tiny little nursery flat which we retrench to during the week. We sleep in the most beautiful bedroom in the whole world with the most beautiful bathroom. And we work downstairs, along stairs, wherever. Yes, I walk a lot of miles a day normally.
When you're open to the public, how do you balance that?
Before COVID came, I would have been a bit sniffy and said, oh, Robert and I are just an inconvenience. We're in the way when we're open to the public. And I can't believe that I actually say this to me, but actually I missed it. And when we opened up at Easter and I could hear the noise of children and happiness walking outside, I suddenly thought, this is what Dean is about. And these houses were built to be shown off. And it is lovely to have them. Of course, it's much more regimented and we have to bring them in, you know, according to COVID rules and regulations. But it is just nice to share the house with, which is why it was built in the first place, really.
So you're really loving being open again properly and sharing your home with people?
At the moment, yes. I mean, the joy is that we are open during the summer, so I do know when we get to the winter, we can close the door and breathe a sigh of relief.
What is your job description?
I'm the defender of Dean.
Yes.
My role is to make sure that the house exists, follows, is looked after, is maintained.
Defender, I like that. Yes. Yeah. You've got your sword at your side. Absolutely. And as defender, do you feel supported here at Dean Park?
Yes and no. I mean, there's always the overriding obstacle is the lack of money. But I have to say, supported. One of the things that drew me to your podcast, and one of the things that I'm not sure anybody else has mentioned, is the fact that I feel great support from the other women in the same position. It's almost like our own livery company or club, because we could be in competition and we're not. We're all there to help each other. And I've always found that that's terribly important, and I will always help others as much as I have been helped.
And it's a very powerful female thing, isn't it?
It is.
Because of course, as you rightly say, I've always said it, there is no competition.
No.
We're all trying to do our best. But whatever we do, we're doing it knowing there's always someone out there who can guide us. It's being done better. It's being done as well. You can be guided. One of the problems I was going to ask you about, Charlotte, is moths. Have you had problems with moths?
Oh, last year, as we couldn't open our houses and we didn't have the visitors coming in, the moths came instead. We had a wonderful chap who we nicknamed Billy the Moth, who came in three times in his hazmat suit, and he came and sprayed everything, and we really did a proper deep clean.
How do you heat Dean Park?
That's a lovely question. When we arrived at Dean Park, there had been a form of heating, but it didn't really work. And they were all these fabulous fan heaters where the fans had all gone. So we shivered. And I remember the first winter, my brother in Germany sent me a fur coat, which belonged to his mother-in-law. So here it is. You'll find the sleeves a bit short, but it's all right because you can wear your marigold gloves with them. And then we had, at the very last minute, we put in a wood chip boiler, which is my absolute nemesis. It's right at the back of the house and incredibly noisy, and I loathe it to bits, but come December and January, it is really rather my best friend.
So what is the secret, Charlotte, to a great British garden?
There's a very simple answer to that one. A great British gardener. We are truly blessed by having wonderful Andrew Jones, who's been here for 20 years now, and he has one helper. And he has the sensibility to realise that what we grow here is suited to what can grow here. And I think we are also blessed in this country of having so many different types of soils and so many different varieties and so many different senses of colour or likes or dislikes. So I think a great British garden should reflect its location.
So as we arrived today, we came down your wonderful drive, and I love the way you've left the grass beautifully long. You met us through the door, which is in itself so welcoming, to arrive at a grand house and then have the lady of the house greet you. And then, of course, we came through the house and out of your front drawing room, we were able to peer at your garden. I mean, that's a treasure. Tell me, who was the person that brought that to life? And
the gardens were, of course, during the Second World War, were grassed over. The parkland had potatoes grown in it and the rest used by tanks. And my late parents-in-law decided to start doing up the garden and building long borders and trying to restore as much as they could remember that was there. So our parterre is probably our absolute prime garden, which was designed by David Hicks. And it's a purple garden. And it's based on the very famous Serlio Renaissance design of a square and a round. And he designed it beautifully so you come through the doors out the steps to fit the pattern. And in it we have very famously four teapots, and these were a sop to my father-in-law, who always had tea at 4 o'clock on the dot every day wherever he was. Yes. And we've even got a teapot on the top of our obelisk, which is at the very entrance there, instead of an orb on the top. So great sense of humour. So we have two gardeners, which is not a great deal, and I keep putting in more gardens. And last year, our wonderful gardener said, please, can you stop? So I've added a rose garden.
Tell us about the rose garden.
The rose garden was my gift to Dean. There were some trees out the side that were not happy. And I thought there had been a herb garden in a cross shape there originally, because there was originally a very old Catholic chapel there. And I designed it with pink, because I'm the only girl in the house. It had to be pink. So all the roses were chosen. They're all David Austin roses, and they were chosen to go dark from the middle out towards pale pink. And they were all chosen because they were, A, first of all, smelt divine, and secondly, named after people we love. So godmothers, cousins, mother-in-laws.
Because I'm sitting with this extraordinary historian on so many levels and the defender of Dean Park, I feel I'm almost in the history lesson myself, to be honest. And one of the things that you have a great connection with, which I want you to tell me everything about, is the Magna Carta. So tell me first, what was the Magna Carta?
The Magna Carta was a charter that was brought about to give freedoms and liberties to the basic Englishman. And there were four initially done. And then I think about 60 years later, there were 11 more made. I discovered from David Starkey that apparently it was the bishops that would issue them. And he said that they were really like yellow pages. If you were given the latest one, you were to destroy the earlier one. So you had the updated version. So there probably are still a few more out there still to be found.
And how many are there now?
I think there's 17 in total, yes. I'm very sad that it was my mother-in-law who found it and managed to sell it, because, of course, you'd like to be the one that sells it today for more money. But they did have great difficulty in selling it, and they sold it in the end to Ross Perot in America for £1 million, and he then turned around and sold it to David Rubenstein for £23 million. And it's currently in the National Archives in Washington underneath the Declaration of Independence. It's been beautifully restored. It's got a fabulous exhibition in it. And when I took William to see it when he was about 16 in Washington, the lovely lady I spoke to there sort of said, gee, I thought you'd want it back. And I said, well, it was sold to restore Dean. And actually, I looked at it and thought, I'd rather have a restored Dean. Possibly because the Magna Carta wasn't issued to Dean. It wasn't absolutely intrinsic to Dean. So I'm happy that it's there. I wouldn't want it back, really. I think it would be an awful responsibility. Yes.
Just tell me, Charlotte, because I don't think I've ever visited a home with so many treasures. So if you were to leave this home at some stage, what would the one thing you would take away with you?
The one thing I'd be allowed to take away is it is a different matter, apart from in the event of fire, my husband and my dogs and my son. We have a map of 1746 by Brazier, which is a map of Dean then. And it has been so useful in historical research. It's got all the gardens in it and the house. It's got wonderful little touches, like the third Earl had a walk-in sunken bath, which I'd love to discover if it's still there. And I would definitely take that off the wall and carry it out because it's not too big and I could probably get it out in the event of a catastrophe quite quickly.
Do you feel an enormous responsibility to do the right thing for Dean, for future generations?
Absolutely. Underlined, written in gold, lit up. Completely. I think we are very blessed in this country to have these amazing houses and castles and palaces and whatever. History matters. We probably don't learn much from it, but we jolly well should. And I would like future generations to come away from experiencing Dean Park as a home, a working home, a loved home, and an important home.
Looking back at the generations that have gone before, what would you, Charlotte Brudenell, say to six generations before you? One of these portraits or one of the ladies in the room next door, what would you say to them sitting here now?
Looking back to the six generations back, I'd say, I'm doing my best. Times have obviously changed. You've all been through dreadful experiences and tightening of belts and whatever, and some of you haven't. So I think, I hope that you're patting me on the back slightly and saying, carry on.
And looking forward?
In the future, I think the most important for them to say is that history matters. Don't be bogged down by it. Don't let the house run you. Enjoy it. And fill it with children.
Oh, that brings a tear to my eye. God bless you, Charlotte Brudenell. She's a supersonic woman. You have to come and see this extraordinary building.
Oh, thank you. I'd like to say an enormous thank you because this has just been music to my ears that your podcast goes out to a lot of people to make them realise how privileged we are, but with it becomes responsibility. And we are a network of ladies who run these houses and they are important. And I think history quite often goes back to the men who've lived in houses and not so much the women who've done quite a lot of the work behind the scenes. So
behind
thank you.
Behind every great man.
Indeed.
When visiting Dean, you'll find so much beauty. The ancient woodland, the Georgian architecture, the rose garden, the wonderful lake, the portraits, the works of art. But most of all, you'll find Charlotte herself. Within Heritage, you are constantly surrounded by the past, living in the present and preparing for the future. In a way, I suppose you're existing within three times all at once. It can be so easy to lose that sense of enthusiasm and awe for what you have and where you are. But Charlotte radiates those emotions. She imparts those feelings to you when you're in her presence. Oh, thank you so much, Charlotte, for sharing your home with all of us today. And thank you, listeners, for joining us as well. Next week, I travel to the historic Renishaw Hall and Garden to meet Alexandra Sitwell, where Alexandra introduces me to an iconic literary trio. I explore the hall's breathtaking art collection and I learn about the hall's reported ghost, the boy in pink. See you then. I'd also just like to thank once again our wonderful sponsor, Circle DNA, for supporting the podcast. If you want to learn more about the great work Circle DNA do and make a real investment into your health, visit their website and use the code THEDUCHESS40 for 40% off their DNA test kits. Couple of quick notes before we go. Important ones. Make sure you subscribe to Duchess the podcast so you get automatically notified about new episodes wherever you listen to a podcast. I want to know about you and what you think of the show, so please be sure to send me your comments and tell me about your own lineage and the women who have inspired you in your life. Please write to me on duchess@duchessthepodcast.com. And if there are any stately homes in particular you'd like me to visit, do send your suggestions to me as soon as possible. I've started a newsletter that includes all this and more and comes straight to your inbox. It's really easy to sign up at duchessthepodcast.com. You've been listening to Duchess, the podcast, presented by me, Emma Rutland, the Duchess of Rutland, produced by One Fine Play in collaboration with Beaver Castle. From Beaver Castle, Lady Violet Manners is the executive producer. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer. Kasra Ferruzia is the audio and visual engineer. Connor Foley is the editorial producer and researcher. Additional creative support from Selena Christofies and Theo Banner. Thanks for listening to Duchess, the podcast.